believe. He is hiding from me, but the spirits say he betrayed you. As crazy as Jackal sounded sometimes, he always came up with bits of information he had no other way of knowing. It made Stike more than a little uncomfortable. Jackal continued,
"The spirits say you're a man of madness. They say death walks in your footsteps just to find an easier road. Some of them fear you. Some hate you. Some like you."
Jackal's eyes narrowed.
"The ones that like you are not of sound mind."
"Thanks for that."
"They also think this is a terrible idea."
"The spirits? What idea?"
"Searching for the Godstones."
Goosebumps spread on the back of Stike's arms. Another piece of information Jackal hadn't, or shouldn't have, been told.
"Have you been spying on us?"
"The spirits bring me a lot of information to sort through. One of the braver ones happened to overhear your conversation with Flint and the other two."
"Taniel and Carpole?"
"The spirits just called them Black and Fire. But, yeah, them. The spirits want nothing to do with the Godstones and think we shouldn't either. The stones are surrounded by a cacophony of death so thick that it drives spirits to madness."
"Well, I didn't know the dead could go mad."
"Madness can follow them from life. But for a spirit to be driven to insanity after death, that's something."
Stike turned toward Jackal and sniffed, trying to sense any sorcery about him. He thought he detected something, a hint of grave moss and fresh-turned dirt, but it was so minuscule it might be his imagination. Was Jackal using some kind of strange new sorcery? Had a knack manifested itself late in life? Stike should be able to smell it, but he hadn't used his sorcerer's senses for 10 years, and he'd never considered the fact he was out of practice. They sat in silence for several minutes. In a nearby field, Ibana was gathering the Mad Lancers and the Riflejack Cavalry for their briefing, minus the scouts keeping an eye on the nearby armies. Stike wondered if he made Ibana do too much of his footwork. But that's what a junior officer was for, was it not? As the senior officer, he sat around, made important decisions. Maybe he'd do some paperwork once in a while, though upon reflection he realized he made Ibana do that as well. He glanced sidelong at Jackal.
"Can the spirits help us find the Godstones?"
Jackal made a sour face.
"I asked. It took almost an hour to get them to talk to me again."
"So that's a no?"
"Definitely no."
"Well," Stike said, lifting his reins, "tell me if they're good for anything."
He turned Amric away from the road and headed off across a shallow gully to where the cavalry was assembled with Ibana. Halfway to Ibana, Carpole met him on horseback. He pulled up, eyeing her for several long moments. Carpole smiled at him, and though he was almost 2 feet taller than her, he found something incredibly terrifying about the casual intensity in her eyes. To his knack, she smelled of coppery old blood.
"So, we're to be your bodyguard, are we?"
She nodded.
"Do you ride well?"
Another nod.
"I don't know your signing language. Is there a better way we can communicate?"
She hesitated, then tapped the side of her head.
"You think of something?"
A nod.
"Try to do it soon."
Stike adjusted Celine in his saddle and wondered how she could sleep so well. Even after 3 weeks on horseback, his thighs and balls still hurt too bad to so much as snooze. "To be young again," he mused.
"Tell me," he said to Carpole, Did I dream you in that town north of Landfall? Did I dream that you wiped blood on my face and disappeared?
She smiled.
You can be coy with Taniel and Flint and everyone else, but I'm going to keep you alive the next few months. Don't play with me. Did I dream that?
She snorted, her face growing serious, then shook her head.
No, I didn't dream it, or no, you didn't do it.
She smiled again.
God damn it!
Snake,
Ibana called. Snake pointed at Carpole.
We'll talk about this again later.
He rode over to where Ibana waited at the head of the assembled cavalry and ran his eyes across them. Most wore the crimson and blue of the rifle jacks. Some volunteers wore whatever they happened to have on them, and the rest wore the old sunflower yellow jackets of the Mad Lancers. Everyone was mounted, facing toward Ibana and Gustar at the front, and each had the reins of an extra horse tied to their saddle. The Mad Lancers had each taken the breastplate of a dead Dionysus cuirassier. Stikes hung from his saddle. He needed a smith to hammer it out to fit him. Their breastplates weren't as strong as those of the riflejack cuirassiers, but they were much lighter, and he decided he'd have the riflejack dragoons fitted with them the next time they slaughtered a Dionysus army.
"Some of you know me from old,"
Stipe began, shouting to be heard across the field.
"Some of you have already ridden under my command at Landfall. And some of you signed on just in the last few days, in which case you will come to know me soon. But for every one of you here today, my name is Ben Stike, and I am your new colonel."
1,000 pairs of eyes watched him silently. Someone in the back cheered, but quickly fell silent.
"I understand that most of you are here for the money, that you followed Lady Flint across the ocean in return for riches. So she is the one who holds your loyalty."
Stike held up a finger.
"Flint has given us one mission and has cut us loose. Your soul belongs to her, but your bodies belong to me. When I tell you to slaughter, you slaughter. When I tell you to burn, you burn. When I say charge, you charge. Anyone who has a problem with that can slink back to her right now and explain that you don't want to follow orders."
No one moved.
"Good," Stike continued. "We will ride hard every day. We will train every day. We will treat our horses with respect. If you fall behind, we will not coddle you, but we will not abandon you either. You will be taught to keep up. It doesn't matter whether you are a cuirassier or a dragoon or a lancer or a farmer or an accountant. From this day forward, you are a Mad Lancer. Mad Lancers are as kind to our allies as we are cruel to our enemies. We take in the broken and we turn them into warriors. We crush those who think themselves invincible. We thrive on the ravages of war. The Mad Lancers protect Fatrasta, even from itself. When all this is over, Lady Flint has assured me that all the survivors will be rich. But mark my words, if you disobey my orders, I will kill you myself."
Stike took a long moment to enjoy the irony of a man famous for ignoring his superiors, expecting unquestioning obedience from his own cavalry, before continuing on in a shout,
"Welcome to the Mad Lancers. We ride as brothers and sisters. We die as brothers and sisters. Let's move out."
He turned immediately to Ibana and Gustar, noting that Celine had woken up during his speech and was looking around groggily.
"How was that?" "Could have been better," Ibana said.
"Go to the pit,"
Stike told her.
"A bit more violent than my boys are used to," Gustav commented. "But I like it."
"They'll learn," Sky warned. "We aren't knights in shining armour. We're killers."
"Adrians have few hang-ups about war," Gustav assured him.
Ibarna sighed.
"I miss me old armour."
She thumped her Dionysus breastplate.
"This won't even stop a good rifle shot."
"Quit your whining. It'll turn a sword or a bayonet. Until we can find out where Lindet stashed our armour, this is the best we got."
Ibarna perked up.
"We're going looking for it."
"It's on my list," Stike said.
He didn't want to get anyone's hopes up. He wasn't entirely certain that Lindet hadn't destroyed it, like she said. But he also had a feeling it was floating around in a Black Hat armory somewhere. If it was on the west coast, he was going to find it.
"Get the men moving," he told Gustav. "We'll head north 2 more miles, then cut through the refugee camp and go west. I'd like to skirt them entirely, but that would take too long. So we'll have to be well on our way before home has any idea we pass through."
Gustav snapped a salute and rode off, shouting for the men to form columns.
"We've got a lot of new volunteers," Stike said, looking over the cavalry. "Are you sure you're going to be able to whip them into shape?"
Ibarna scoffed.
"You may be an old cripple, but I'm in the prime of my life. If we turn farmers and dockhands into cavalry during the Fitrastan War, we can do it now."
She paused for a moment.
"I'm surprised you said yes to this. That eager to be cut loose?"
Stike considered the question for several moments, looking down at Celine, who was content to watch the activity without comment.
"The longer we stick around, the more likely it'll be that Flint and I come to blows. I don't want that to happen."
"Sure.
But it's not just that. Flint has sent us west. What's to the west?"
Ibarna shrugged.
Stike held up 3 fingers. "Bad Tenny Wiles, Valyane, and Javori."
A wicked little smile crossed Ibarna's face. Stike continued.
"I figure there's a pretty good chance we come across those bastards while we look for this thing for Lady Flint. And I really like the idea of mixing business and revenge."
Chapter 11 Mikael spent the next few days after losing his safe house trying to ascertain just how much damage had been done. He left notes for Hendris at preordained drop points, tried to chase down a handful of trusted contacts, and stewed in his own frustration at a small hovel on the edge of Greenfire Depths, the first address on Taniel's list of resources. He was just about to give up hope that Hendris had escaped the Dionysus when he found a note at one of the drop points. "Still alive. Safe house compromised. Meet at 14 Laurel Way, 2 p.m. We'll wait for 2 days. Hendris's neat handwriting was unmistakable. The meeting spot was in a posh area of landfall called Middle Heights. Before the invasion, it was the favoured locale of the Fratrastan elite. The streets were wide and cobbled, lined with immense townhouses, with every street corner lit by gaslight during the night. There were museums, theatres, and fine restaurants. Even Mikkel's favourite whorehouse was in Middle Heights, though he could rarely afford it. Since the invasion, everything had changed. Middle Heights was practically a ghost town. Homes and businesses were boarded up in a vain attempt to prevent looting. Only about 1 in 10 residences were still occupied, and the big public buildings were either guarded by Dionysus soldiers or had been taken over by squatters. Rumour had it that the Dionysus planned on moving their own low-level bureaucracy into the mansions of Middle Heights, but so far there was only an average Dionysus presence in the area. Mikael headed to the indicated meeting spot an hour early, and did a slow walk around the block. 14 Laurel Way was a big theatre. Only a few years old, it was the pride of some Brudanian investors, with an immense stone facade decorated by gargoyles and columns. The newspapers spoke much about the maze-like tunnels beneath the main stage, with state-of-the-art lever and pulley systems that would allow actors to descend from the catwalks or pop up from the floor anywhere on stage. There was graffiti on the outside walls admonishing the Dionysus invaders in Palo, and the tents of homeless squatters covered the immense floor of the columned front portico. Mikhail walked through the tents, glancing in at the faces. They were mostly Palo, refugees from the fires in Greenfire Depths, and no one questioned him as he passed. He tried the front door to find it barricaded from inside, then headed around to the alleyways, his eyes sharp for Dionysus soldiers, though it soon became clear that he needn't worry. The Dionysus had clearly decided to ignore this place, at least for now. Mikhail did a second circuit of the block, eyeing the squatters and checking the windows and roofs of the nearby townhouses, before heading back around to the front steps and settling down to wait. 30 minutes passed. Then an hour. And it was almost 2:30 before he finally spotted Hendriz hurrying down the street toward him. He stood up, hands clasped behind his back, and frowned. She walked hurriedly, her eyes on the doorways of the townhouses as she passed them, constantly searching. She seemed off. "Ignore it," he whispered to himself. "She's had a rough couple of days, too." "She's carrying a pistol beneath her jacket," he retorted. "You better damn well keep your eyes peeled." He still glanced over his shoulder, checking his escape route around the back of the theatre. She spotted him and crossed the street, picking her way slowly through the tents, her face worried. He tried to give her a reassuring smile and raised his hand in greeting. "Glad to see you in one piece," he said. Hendriz flashed a quick smile, and Mikhail felt that same gut response he'd gotten outside of the safe house a few days ago. Something was wrong. He could see it in her gait and in her face. He did a quick glance around, looking for any sign of Dionysus soldiers, but came up with nothing. "What's wrong?" he asked. "I'm fine," she said. "Still a little shaken up. I went out after you did the other day. It was pure luck that I wasn't there when the Dionysus showed up." Mikhail ran a hand through his hair. "Shit. I was hoping you'd be able to tell me why they were there." "Why would I be able to tell you?" The words were a little too quick, accompanied by a look full of suspicion. Two and two clicked together in Mikhail's head, and he held up his hands. "You don't think I tipped them off, do you?" Hendriz hesitated. She did. She definitely did, and that had Mikhail worried. "I don't know," she said. "I didn't tip anyone off," Mikhail assured her. "I came back that evening and spotted them staking out the safe house. I'm glad you did the same." "Shit! Shit!" He began to pace, his mind racing. Not only did he have to figure out why the Dionysus were at his safe house, but he also had to convince Hendriz he hadn't betrayed her. "Look, one of us might have been followed. We might have been sold out, or we might have just gotten unlucky. The Dionysus are cracking down more than ever since those grenades the other day. We need to find another safe house and regroup. We have to make sure our routes out the city haven't been compromised, too." "I..." Hendriz seemed to consider his words, the corners of her eyes tightening. Her mouth formed into a firm line, and she said, "I don't think so."
"What do you mean?"
The last words had barely left Mikhail's mouth when he heard footsteps behind him. He glanced over his shoulder to see a tall woman with black hair cut short on the sides in the style of the Stalish military. Her name was Ethel, and he recognized her as an Iron Rose who had worked beneath him on occasion the last few years. She ambled up behind him, her jaw set. Mikhail forced down a rising panic and shoved his hands into his pockets.
"What's going on, Hendris?"
"You betrayed us," Hendris said, her tone flat. "You betrayed me."
"I didn't tip off those Dianites," Mikhail hissed. "Don't lie to me. I'm not!" "This is a damn big misunderstanding. We need to go somewhere and talk this out."
Hendris gave a resigned sigh, her lip curling.
"I saw you with him, Mikhail."
"Who?"
"The other day. The day the Dianites found our safe house, I saw you meeting with the Red Hand."
Mikhail felt the bottom of his stomach drop out. He swallowed hard, searching for words.
Hendris continued. "I came back to find the safe house being watched. I'm not a spy, Mikhail, but I'm not an idiot either. I did a little asking around. You were with the Red Hand when Fidelis Jess died. You met with him again the other day. You're a damn traitor. You're going to come with us now and tell us everything you know, or this is going to get very painful for you. Don't make it worse."
Mikhail's mouth was dry. He knew Blackheart's better than most, and he knew the line she just fed him was bullshit. If he went with them, it wouldn't matter what he said. Things would get painful either way. He squeezed his eyes closed for a moment, feeling every bit of control slip away from him. This wasn't how it was supposed to go. The fingers of his right hand slipped into his knuckle dusters. "Look," he said, pulling his hands slowly out of his pockets. He heard another footstep behind him, judged the distance, and turned around, cocking Ethel in the side of the jaw. It took the Iron Rose completely by surprise. Ethel crumpled, and Mikhail stumbled past her and broke into a run, heading for the alley around the back of the theatre.
"You piece of shit!" he heard Hendris shout.
The words were followed by the blast of a pistol, and he ducked as a bullet ricocheted off the stone facade of the theatre just above his head. Hendris swore again, louder, and he heard her footsteps pound after him. He rounded the side of the theatre and headed down the alley, leaping trash and dodging the tents of squatters. Faces watched with concern as he raced by, no doubt drawn out by the sound of the pistol shot. Mikhail was a couple of dozen yards from the next street when a figure loomed in the mouth of the alley. It was Geddy, a short, stocky, Iron Rose with black hair and a beard. Mikhail skidded to a stop, glancing over his shoulder to see Hendris bearing down on him, fury in her eyes. She held a pistol by the barrel, raised above her head to strike. Mikhail's only option was the chimney sweep's ladder going up the side of the theatre. He slipped the knuckle dusters back into his pants pocket and leapt for the lowest rung, pulling himself up. He scrambled up the ladder, only stopping when he reached a window ledge about 40 feet up. He hooked his toe between the ladder rung and the wall and took off his jacket, wrapping it around his fist in one swift motion and punching it through the window. He swept off the jagged edges and leapt inside. He entered through an office that had obviously been ransacked. Papers lay scattered on every surface, and a large safe stood open in one corner. Mikhail dashed across the room and out into the hall, racing through the darkness and down a flight of stairs. He twisted his ankle as he reached the landing, swearing to himself quietly, and pausing just long enough to listen for sound of pursuit. Nothing. He continued on down to the next floor, and then along another hallway, this one pitch black. He navigated by feel and the memory of a previous visit, when he'd come here to do a favour for one of the theatre investors. Within moments, he burst out a door, around a narrow turn, and out into the lobby. The lobby had seen better days. A few squatters had taken up residence below the enormous stained-glass skylight, and they looked up at him as he entered. The front door was blocked by a chair from one of the offices. Mikael dismissed it as an exit, worried about running into Ethel or Hendris. He looked down to the other side of the lobby, where he knew that a hidden door allowed performers to pass beneath the theatre seats and pop up to entertain guests before a show. He was just a few steps down the main staircase when there was a sudden crash. The front door burst open, the chair flying, and a very angry-looking Ethel strode through the opening. Mikael grabbed the banister and spun himself around, heading back up. He reached the main theatre and threw the curtain aside, running recklessly down the aisle with little regard for his twisted ankle or the possibility of breaking something during his descent. Aside from the little light coming in through the way he'd just entered, the theatre was pitch black. He reached the bottom and threw himself to the floor. Back up at the lobby entrance, he saw a tall silhouette, and Ethel called out, "We're going to find you, traitor, and I'm going to kill you myself." "So much for talking my way out of this," Mikael muttered to himself. He crawled quickly along the floor, around the orchestra pit, and up onto the stage. "He's down here," he heard Ethel call. A moment later, there was a second silhouette, briefly outlined by the light from the lobby. Hendris. "Geddy," Hendris shouted. "See if you can find the gas line for the main theatre. Turn on the lights and he's ours." Ethel responded with something that Mikael could not understand, but he used it to pinpoint her position about halfway up the theatre seating. Quietly, he slipped his shoes off and soft-footed his way across the stage and into the wings. He tried to see something, anything, in the inky darkness behind the curtains. His memory of a brief tour of the backstage was fuzzy, and he followed it haphazardly into the darkness, barking his shins on crates and running into stage props. Mikael finally found an empty hall and followed it down a flight of stairs and through two curtains before emerging into the storage area beneath the stage. A dim light coming from street-level windows at the far end of the long room allowed him to pick out the dressing areas and the enormous set pieces. Everything was set up as if for a performance, likely forgotten when news came of the invasion. Mikael paused long enough to put his shoes back on, then began to head to the far side of the room, where he thought he remembered an exit that came out on the other side of the street behind the theatre. The figure that emerged from the next stairwell took him entirely by surprise. He only got a quick glance, enough to see the stocky figure of Geddy coming out of the shadows. Before he was grabbed by the shoulders and thrown through an enormous canvas painting of a wooded countryside. Mikael stumbled and fell on the other side, crashing into an array of pulleys with enough force to rattle his teeth. He pulled himself up, only in time to catch Geddy's fist in his kidneys. He'd seen Geddy work before. Geddy was considered, even among Iron Roses, to be the go-to man for roughing up an enemy of the Chancellor's office. The blow doubled Mikael over and sent him reeling into a wooden set-piece, gasping for breath and holding up one hand in the vain hope of stalling Geddy's approach. "He's down here!" Geddy shouted. He reached out and snagged Mikael by the arm. To Mikael's surprise, he managed to slip right out of Geddy's grip, allowing him a precious few seconds to backpedal. He snatched his knuckle-dusters from his pocket and forced himself into a boxer's stance, only then noticing that his left arm was coated with blood. Mikael didn't have time to consider it. Geddy came on quickly, fists swinging. Mikael stepped to one side, taking a glancing blow to the shoulder, and slammed his fist into Geddy's temple as hard as he could. Geddy took two wobbly steps to one side, touching his cheek, fingers coming away bloody. Mikael didn't give him the time to focus. He grabbed one of Geddy's thick forearms and smashed his knuckle-dusters into Geddy's elbow until Geddy began to scream. He pulled back, punched him one more time in the side of the head, and turned and ran. Mikael backtracked, past the stairway he descended from, and all the way to the wall of the understage, where he found a narrow corridor leading into the darkness.
Hoping he knew what he was doing, he placed his palms on both walls of the corridor to keep his balance and hurried down it. He emerged a short time later through a trapdoor into the lobby. The door boomed against the floor as Mikkel came through it, and he didn't bother to pause as he scrambled out the front door and into the street. In the light of day, he found his left arm deeply gouged by the glass of the window he'd broken. There was blood on his face from hitting the pulleys, and a deep pain in his side from Geddy's punches. The self-examination took him just a few seconds. He spotted a curious palo looking out from his tent on the front steps of the theatre.
"You," Mikkel said, searching his pockets.
He came up with a booklet of meal vouchers for the Dionysus market out by the docks. He shoved it into the palo's hands.
"Sell me your jacket. Quickly! And if someone comes out that door, tell them I went that way."
Mikkel practically pulled the jacket off the poor palo and hurried across the street and down an alley. He zigzagged through afternoon traffic, hoping his bloody face and arm didn't attract too much attention. He was half a dozen blocks from the theatre before he finally allowed himself to rest in a dirty alleyway outside a baker's shop. He stared at the blood dripping from his fingers and the knuckle duster still on his other hand, and felt true despair for the first time since the Dionysus had invaded. Hendris knew who he really was. The Black Hats left in the city would come for him. Mikkel was now truly alone.
Chapter 12
"The Vetrustans and Dionysus have engaged!"
Flora knelt by a creek and splashed water on her face, cleaning off the grime of the road. She relished the shock of the cold water coming out of the foothills, scrubbing her cheeks, enjoying the moment of respite. She climbed to her feet and dried off with a handkerchief, turning to find the scout standing a few feet behind her. It was late in the afternoon, and she knew she would have to give the order to make camp soon, but she wanted her infantry to eke out another mile or two before nightfall.
"What happened?" she asked the scout.
"The Dionysus turned to follow us when we left," the scout reported. "They sent a brigade in our tracks, but the Vetrustans engaged around noon, and the brigade was forced to pull back."
"Full engagement?" Flora asked hopefully. "Did you see the battle?"
"No, Mum. Just skirmishing. Last I saw before coming to report was the Dionysus consolidating."
"Very good." Flora wiped her hands on her handkerchief and returned it to her pocket, dismissing the scout. She turned her face toward the sun and closed her eyes, listening to the tramp of marching soldiers making their way along the winding road of the foothills just a few hundred yards down the creek. A pair of swallows chased each other overhead.
"That was a clever bit of manoeuvring."
Flora jumped, her pistol halfway out of her belt, before she spotted Taniel sitting just above her on the hillside. He wore his buckskins, matching satchels hanging from his shoulders, and leaned on his Hrush rifle with a casual air as if he'd been there for an hour. She felt a spike of annoyance and couldn't help but think that she wouldn't be in this mess if not for him.
"Don't sneak up on me."
"Sorry."
"Don't be sorry, just don't do it."
Flora returned to her horse for her canteens and filled them at the creek. She was suddenly self-conscious, aware of Taniel's gaze following her.
"Did Carpole get away fine with the Mad Lancers?"
Taniel spread his legs, laying his rifle across them and checking the flint and pan.
"She did. They're southwest of us right now and riding hard. As far as we know, they're not being followed."
This information surprised Flora.
"You can speak with her at a distance?"
"Not exactly."
Taniel looked suddenly uncomfortable.
"We can sense each other, feel each other's pains and attitudes. It's very rudimentary, but it's a sort of communication."
That sounds convenient. It's a pain in the ass, actually. If she feels pain 100 miles from me, there's nothing I can do about it, and vice versa. It can be comforting, but it can also make me anxious as pit.
Laura tried to dredge up some sympathy. There wasn't much to find, so she walked up the side of the hill and sat down next to him.
"Tell me about where we're going."
"I don't know much myself," Taniel admitted. "All I could find in Lindert's private archives was a reference to a place called Yellow Creek. As far as I could tell, she'd been working off old Dionysus texts to pinpoint the location of the other godstones, using translations and some sort of mathematical formula her privileged had cooked up."
Flora felt a sudden weight in her stomach.
"You mean this could be a wild goose chase?"
Taniel lifted his hands defensively. "If I thought it was a wild goose chase, I wouldn't have offered to pay you a rather large fortune for your help. Lindert's not the only one who's been looking for all three godstones, and the two guesses she's mapped out for our missing artifacts are in the same area as my own estimates. That can't be coincidence."
"That doesn't make me feel any better."
Flora mulled it over. No use wishing to be somewhere else. The deal was struck, and she and her men were in this for the long haul.
"Yellow Creek. The name sounds familiar."
"It's a mining town," Taniel said. "They..."
Flora cut him off, remembering an article she'd read in the newspaper almost a year ago.
"They struck gold there, right?
A big-time haul. Thousands of prospectors from all over the world have gathered there."
"Right. What else?"
"Well, that's about all I know."
Taniel grimaced.
"Well, maybe not all I know."
"What?" Flora asked, her eyes narrowing involuntarily. Taniel himself was enough of a surprise and a mystery that she didn't need anything else. She wanted this job to be as straightforward as possible. Track down the godstone, smash anything or anyone who gets in the way, then figure out how to destroy the thing. The moment it was in 1,000 pieces, she intended to be on a boat back to Adro.
"There's a complication with Yellow Creek. Technically, the land it's on is claimed by 3 different countries.
"Who?"
"Fatrasta, Brudania, and the Palo Nation."
Flora wasn't surprised about the first two. Lindert had claimed the entire continent for her country and was fighting for the legality of her claim with 6 colonial powers who still held some land in Fatrasta. But the other? She tried to search her memories. The Palo was spread out in 1,000 tribes over a landmass almost as large as the 9. The actual nation of Fatrasta claimed the whole continent of the same name, but in reality only controlled pieces on the eastern and southern coasts. There were millions of square miles of dense forests northwest of the Ironhook Mountains that only a few Cressians had ever managed to penetrate. The Palo Nation was a coalition of those northern tribes, but she never heard anything about them beyond conjecture. To Flora's knowledge, Lindit's frontier armies had only ever fought tribes who themselves had opposed the Palo Nation, bringing back rumours of walled cities, farmland, and even organized government. It seemed like a fairy tale back when Flora was putting down insurrections by tribes still living in huts in the swamps.
"I didn't know the Palo Nation claimed land. In fact, I don't know much about them at all."
"No one does," Taniel said, kicking at a clod of dirt with his heel. "Which makes them dangerous. Last I heard, they were contesting gold claims in the Iron Hook Mountains. I'm not exactly sure what that means, though."
"So we might reach Yellow Creek and find a Palo army waiting for us?"
"I'm guessing we're more likely to find the town being harassed by a skirmishing party."
Either way, we should be ready for violence.
Laura pursed her lips.
I suppose that's my job, anyway.
She considered the facts for a few moments, realizing how little she knew. I don't want to march into contested territory without scouting it first.
I wouldn't expect you to, Tamuel said. But if you want to make camp and scout out Yellow Creek, you can't take long.
Why not?
Because at some point, Lindet is going to find out what we're up to and send a whole field army to come bury us.
Or, Vlora mused, the Dianais will crush Lindet's troops and try to figure out where we went.
Either one.
Vlora got to her feet, dusting off her trousers.
It's settled, then.
She had the brief satisfaction of seeing Tanyel surprised as she got on her horse.
What is?
He asked. We have to get moving. I'm going to find Olam. Olam was at the rear of the army, riding along behind the last few carts of provisions in the long and winding columns. He wore a thoughtful expression, leaning back in his saddle with a hand gently patting his horse's flank as he hummed a tune.
"I just sent someone to find you," he said by way of greeting.
Laura waited by the road and then nudged her horse up next to his, letting them walk together.
"Anything important?"
she asked.
"Another of our rear scouts just reported in. The Dianais and Fortrustan Field Army skirmished all afternoon, but it looks like they've made camp on either side of the river and are content to feel each other out. For now."
"That could be ideal for us."
"Could be," Olam agreed. "Both armies have a handful of scouts following us. They want to know where we're headed."
That was decidedly not ideal. They couldn't hide a whole army, of course, not even up in the Iron Hook foothills, but she'd hoped to make a clean break that would keep their location a mystery for at least a few weeks.
"How many horses did we keep for ourselves?"
60 dragoons, Olam said. "Everyone else went with steak."
Flora chewed on the number, watching as Tanyel rode over a nearby hill and joined them.
"Leave 20 of them behind to set some ambushes," she told Olam. "Scare off the scouts or delay them. Just buy us a little more time until they figure out where we're heading. I don't want either the Fortrustans or Dianais following us to Yellow Creek."
"Will do."
"With any luck, the two armies will be so tied up with each other that we're an afterthought. At least for now."
She glanced at Tanyel, who'd hung his rifle from his saddle and pulled out a sketchbook. He began to sketch quickly, his eyes on the hillside to their left, expertly dashing bits of charcoal against the paper along with the cadence of his horse's gait.
"We have a problem," she said to Olam.
"Which is?"
"We know nothing about what we're walking into."
"Yellow Creek!"
Olam produced a pre-rolled cigarette from his pocket and offered it to Vlora, then to Tanyel. They both shook their heads. He shrugged and lit it for himself.
"It's a gold rush town. I've got nothing more than that."
"That's what Tanyel said too,"
Vlora said, jerking her thumb at Tanyel, who had covered half the page of his sketchbook in charcoal markings in less than a minute.
"But that doesn't really help us."
"What do you propose?"
Olam asked. Laura hesitated.
"You're not going to like this."
"You want to go ahead and scout it yourself, don't you?"
Olam ashed his cigarette and scowled at Laura.
"I definitely won't like that."
"We can't just ride in at the head of an army.
At best, the locals will send runners to all the closest cities asking for help, thinking we're trying to move in on their claims. At worst, we'll run into a stubborn militia and won't even be able to get into the town without bloodshed." Olam fixed her with a long, steady gaze.
"And sending me with a squad isn't an option?"
"Even in plain clothes you'll stand out," Vlora replied. "A squad of soldiers always looks like a squad of soldiers, even when dressing down."
Taniel suddenly put away his charcoal, flipping the leather cover over his sketchbook before she could see what he'd been drawing. He looked from Vlora to Olam, then said, "There isn't anything in Yellow Creek that Vlora and I can't handle." "I don't remember inviting you," Vlora said, turning to Taniel.
"Do you know what we're looking for?"
Taniel asked. "An obelisk seeped in sorcery and covered in Dionysus writing."
"Maybe."
"What do you mean, maybe?"
"We have no idea if the godstones all look the same," Taniel said. "Until Mikkel told me about the one outside Landfall, I thought I was looking for an artifact the size of a pair of saddlebags. We still might be. Besides, my senses are more highly tuned than yours. If we get within 100 yards or so of the godstone, I should be able to find it."
Vlora and Olam exchanged a glance. "Give us a minute," she told Taniel. She pulled gently on her reins, coming to a stop, while Olam did the same. They waited for almost a minute as the column marched on, until they wouldn't be overheard even by Taniel's powder mage senses.
"Do you trust him?"
Olam asked. It was a question Vlora had been mulling over for weeks.
"I trust him to not get me killed."
"And beyond that?"
"I have no idea," she confessed. "I'm still not even sure what he is. Beau told me he's become something more than just a powder mage. He's transcended into something new."
She considered Borbador, her and Taniel's mutual adopted brother, wishing briefly that he was riding alongside her. He would know what to make of Taniel. Olam took a drag on his cigarette.
"That doesn't give me a lot of confidence. You should at least take our mages with you."
"And leave the army undefended against Privileged or Bone Eyes?"
Vlora shook her head. "Not a chance."
"Just one," Olam pressed. "Take Nareen. She's known Taniel for longer than you have. She'll watch both your backs and can pull you out of trouble if Taniel gets himself into something only he can handle."
"No, you need her here. Look, I can handle Taniel. I can handle a gold rush town. You've got to trust me on this. I'm going to leave you in command, and I need to know that you're focused on that and not spending all your energy worrying about me."
Olam looked at her glumly. He spat into the weeds and let out a sigh.
"Fine."
"Good. As long as no one is on our tail, you can let the army take it easy from here to Yellow Creek. Find somewhere a dozen miles outside the city to camp and send someone in to find us. With any luck, we'll have already destroyed the godstone and be ready to leave."
"You don't have that much luck."
"No," Vlora agreed. "I don't." She paused, thinking about Beau again.
"Do me another favour."
"What's that?"
"Dispatch a letter to Adipest. Send 3 copies with 3 different couriers, so you know it gets there."
"From here? It'll be 6 weeks on the fastest ship."
"Send it anyway. I want Beau to know what's going on here. Tell him about the godstones, and that both Lindet and the Dionysus want to use them."
Olam barked a laugh. "That sounds like a trail of catnip for a kitten. Do you really want Beau to come here? I'm not entirely certain he won't throw his own hat in the ring to become a god."
"Beau is a lot of things, but power-hungry is not one of them. He may show up with the intent to study the damn things, but..."
She trailed off.
"But what?"
"But I think having him here would do more good than harm. If only slightly."
She paused. "Oh, and tell him to bring his better half. I wouldn't mind having the strongest privilege in the 9 standing over my shoulder."
"I know they're your friends," Olam said softly. "But involving them could be dangerous."
"Then I better hurry," Vlora replied, "so that this whole business is finished before Beau can even set sail." She flipped her reins, riding to catch up with the army, and calling over her shoulder,
"I'll leave first thing in the morning. I expect to see you in my tent at sundown, Colonel."
Chapter 13.
After 24 hours, Mikkel still couldn't stop the bleeding. There were 3 long slices down his left arm, all from the glass at the theatre. One was manageable, but the other 2 were far worse than he'd first expected. His one-handed stitch job was sloppy at best, constantly pulling out, and it seemed as if the cuts began to bleed again every time he moved. He stayed in Taniel's hovel of a safe house for the entire morning, trying to fix the stitches while he considered his next course of action. He started by cursing himself for allowing Hendris to follow him that afternoon he met with Taniel. He hadn't even considered that she might, and the oversight had cost him both her friendship and whatever resources were still left to the Blackhats in Landfall. Manpower, food, and safe houses were all compromised. He wondered if perhaps he could still use Black Hat resources sparingly. Hendres couldn't spread the word that far, not with the Dainais hunting down any Black Hat left in the city. He might be able to get to some of his contacts first, throwing suspicion on Hendres. If he found the gold roses that Taniel said had stayed behind, well, that would be something. Mikkel made a list of the contacts he knew had remained in the city. It was pitifully short, and even shorter when he crossed off the ones that Hendris knew about. Despair began to set in, quietly at first, nagging at the back of his mind, then slowly growing. The pain from his arm made it difficult to think straight. The more he considered that he was in an occupied city, cut off from Taniel and now friendless, the more he considered abandoning Taniel's mission and fleeing Landfall. Was this Dainai's informant really important enough to face these odds? He forced himself to breathe deeply, drinking straight from a bottle of whiskey to dull the pain. He wasn't completely friendless. Taniel had left him with a number of contacts. They were only to be used in an emergency, but this was beginning to feel as if it qualified. Mikkel needed information, resources, and, best of all, someone who could stitch up his arm. He picked a name from his mental list of Taniel's contacts. It had been marked specifically as someone Mikkel could trust to speak freely around, which sounded like a damn good start. Mikkel wrapped his left arm tightly and put on a shirt and jacket, then headed out into the street. He wore a flat cap and high-collared style of jacket he had not worn around Hendra's. The journey was uneventful, and he soon found himself entering a small building on the northern side of the Hadshaw Gorge, marked with the single word, Morgue.
"This isn't a good idea," he whispered to himself.
"Taniel said he could be trusted."
Mikkel licked his lips.
"I'm not talking about that. The morgue is underground. I don't know all the exits."
"Don't be a baby," he responded to himself. "It's not a doctor, but a mortician is going to be able to stitch you up better than you can yourself. Get in there."
Reluctantly, he obeyed his own promptings. There was an empty reception desk and little else, but a stairway that led down into the plateau, so Mikkel followed it down, thankful for the gas lamps that lit every landing. The air grew cool, and he soon picked up the butcher-like smell of corpses and the harsh, chemical scent of embalming fluid. The staircase finally ended, leaving him in a long, wide hallway cut into the rock. Open doors led off either side of the hall, and as he passed them, he saw dozens of bodies in various states of undress and of obviously diverse deaths laid out on marble slabs. He had yet to spot anyone living when he heard the gentle sound of humming coming from the final doorway on the left. Mikkel approached the open door and took a moment to examine the man standing inside. He was an albino, tall and slim, with a receding hairline in a shock of fine white hair. He stood straight, chin lifted, peering down his nose through a pair of green-tinted glasses at a body laid out in front of him. As Mikkel watched, the albino painted black dotted lines on the corpse with a tiny brush, stopping occasionally to examine his work and rub out one of the lines with his thumb before correcting it. Mikkel cleared his throat. The albino looked up at him, blinking in surprise behind those green-tinted glasses.
"Oh, hello. I'm sorry I didn't see you there. If you're dropping off, we're almost out of space, but you can put up to 3 more bodies in room 7.
"I'm not dropping off," Mikkel responded. "I'm looking for someone."
"I see."
The albino spoke in clean, crisp Adran, and Mikkel immediately pegged him as well-studied. It was the accent of someone with the best education.
"I am the only one here, unfortunately. Unless you're looking for me, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to go. The morgue is not open to the public."
"Are you Emerald?"
The albino examined Mikkel for a moment before making a gentle sound and setting down his paintbrush. He tapped his green-tinted glasses.
"Emerald is a nickname. My real name is Kevi Karevenrian, and I am the chief mortician at the Landfall City Morgue."
"Right. You're the one I'm looking for."
Mikkel took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeve to reveal blood-soaked bandages.
"If it's not too much trouble, I need you to stitch this up for me."
Emerald looked taken aback.
"You want a doctor, sir? I think someone has sent you to me as a joke."
His eyes narrowed.
"Tell me, who gave you that name? Emerald? Only my friends know me by that."
"Look, I don't know you, but we have a mutual friend. His name is Taniel."
Emerald made that sound again.
"I see. And you are?"
"Mikkel Bravis at your service. Or rather, I'm hoping you'll be at mine."
Mikkel indicated his wounded arm with a hopefully charming smile.
"Do you have a password?"
"Touch the noontime bells," Mikkel responded. It was the last password he'd used with any of Taniel's people. He hoped it was current.
"And listen to them ring," Emerald finished. "Well then, Mikkel Bravis, give me your arm."
He took Mikkel gently by the shoulder and led him to a workbench in the corner, where he quickly began to unwrap Mikkel's bandages.
"I was told you'd only contact me in the event of an emergency," he spoke as he worked, a flash of annoyance crossing his face. "Taniel left town just 5 days ago. Has it all gone wrong so quickly?"
Mikkel considered how to answer. Taniel had expressed complete trust in his contacts, but he hadn't actually told Mikkel how much information they knew. Emerald knew both Taniel and Mikkel's real names, so that was a start.
"It hasn't gone, well."
"I would say it hasn't."
Emerald finished unwrapping the arm and turned it one way, then the other, to examine the 3 cuts.
"I have seen rheumatic blind men make tighter stitches than these."
"Thanks," Mikkel said flatly. "Can you fix them?"
"I have doctorates from 4 different medical colleges. If I can't do a better job than this, I should kill myself now."
He rummaged through his workbench before coming up with a needle and thread. Without warning, he began to pick out Mikkel's stitches.
"Ow! Oh, yes, this will sting a little. Tell me, Mikkel, does Taniel know that the black cats have turned on you? Or was that after he left?"
Mikkel tried to pull his arm away, but Emerald snatched him by the bicep with his free hand. "Hold still, please." Mikkel swore under his breath.
How much do you know?
You don't know whether to trust me, Emerald stated. He finished pulling the stitches from one cut and began to read.